Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Today we begin the show in Washington, D.C. This week's Supreme Court ruling on the EPA and its ability to regulate carbon is a mixed bag for Wyoming officials and energy producers. Matt Laszlo reports from Washington that it sets the stakes even higher for Republicans in the state who are determined to derail a pending EPA rule on climate change.
Like most all things here in Washington these days, the recent Supreme Court ruling in favor of the EPA is being read along party lines. But Wyoming Senator Mike Enzi says it's not just partisanship. He says your opinion also hinges on where you're reading.
Yeah, it depends on whether you're reading the Eastern papers or the Western papers.
Standing outside the Senate floor, Enzi explains.
Eastern papers seem to think that they gave the EPA the authority to regulate just about anything they wanted to. The Western reports on it point out that there were just a very closely delineated set of pollutants, which did not include CO2, because that's so common in the atmosphere.
Here it is in plain English. The High Court reaffirmed its previous rulings, giving the EPA authority to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. But justices also scolded the agency, writing that executive branch bureaucrats can't rewrite or fill in laws on a whim, even if well-intentioned. They need Congress to rewrite the law if they want more authority to tackle contemporary problems like climate change. Enzi sees that section as a major victory for Wyoming energy producers.
Clear message that they sent in that was that they can't rewrite laws themselves, but we're the ones in charge, Congress is the ones in charge of writing the laws, and that they have to abide by those laws even if they don't think they're firm enough or stern enough or well-defined enough.
While both sides agree this ruling was limited, Republicans are hoping it foreshadows the court battle that's sure to come over the newly unveiled EPA rule that's expected to halt the construction of new coal-fired power plants. Wyoming Senator John Barrasso says the writing is on the wall for administration officials.
Well, I think the words to show that the EPA doesn't have the kind of authority to continue the overreach they're doing is important because the EPA has gone way beyond the original intent of the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, in my opinion.
Lawmakers who want the EPA to curb carbon emissions on its own see it differently. Conservative Justice Antonin Scalia wrote the opinion scolding the EPA. Virginia Democratic Congressman Jim Moran says Barrasso and other Republicans are misreading the decision. Moran says Scalia was merely pandering. He says the court's opinions granting the EPA broad power over carbon pollution trump this recent ruling.
I think he had to do that for his conservative base. Some of these justices are more political than the politicians in town.
Still, Republicans see a window, and they're itching for a fight. Congresswoman Cynthia Lummis is urging Wyoming's governor to double down on his past challenges of the administration.
I do hope that Governor Meade will prepare to sue the federal government with all of these overreaches.
Lummis is hoping she and other House Republicans can tie the administration's hands from their perch in the Capitol.
We are looking at limitations on spending. We're looking at oversight hearings that expose this massive overreach and massive shift. And quite frankly, at this point, those hearings that expose the overreach are our best tool.
The fight is different in the democratically controlled Senate. Minority Leader Mitch McConnell is in an intense fight to keep his post representing Kentucky, the nation's third largest coal-producing state. He's currently holding up legislation to fund essential government functions in order to get an up or down vote on a bill to undercut the EPA's new rule. Senator Enzi says McConnell's amendment will go a long way in Wyoming, the nation's leading coal-producing state.
I think he's got an important amendment for Wyoming. You know, we need to clarify what we're doing, and we should get a vote on it. If there are 51 people around here that think that the EPA has gone too far, the EPA ought to be told so. And I think there would easily be 51 people that would do that.
Barrasso agrees. He says the Senate Majority Leader is stifling free debate.
You know, Harry Reid has run the Senate in a dictatorial fashion. He's put a muzzle order on both Republicans and Democrats. We ought to be able to bring bills to the floor of the United States Senate for debate and vote. And Harry Reid, with his gag order, is not just muzzling Republicans, he's also muzzling Democrats.
It's not just Republicans complaining. There's growing discontent among younger Democratic senators to vote on a wide array of proposals, including energy legislation. But Virginia Senator Tim Kaine says Reid is merely responding to a Republican Party that wants to halt the administration at every turn.
We need more amendments. And look, I think Leader Reid is frustrated by a process that has made it difficult to do.
Kaine, who also has large coal fields in part of his state, says the process needs to be more open, even though many of those votes, like on the EPA, won't always be easy.
Look, we all come here to do work. Amendments is part of the work. Legislation is part of the work. Not every vote is just going to be a light and easy one. They're going to have to take some risks. Everybody will have to, but that's good for the body. And I think we'll find a path to make an improvement.
Control of the Senate is at stake in this fall's elections, and energy policy is expected to play a major role in the fight for control of the upper chamber. Whether Wyoming senators ever get to tie the EPA's hands remains to be seen. Until then, all they really are left with are the nation's courts. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
As energy development increases across the country, many states are starting to look into whether or not it would be a good idea to set up databases to track possible health impacts directly attributed to energy development. Colorado has developed an extensive system within its Department of Health to track and investigate healthcare impacts. The state of Wyoming has not developed such a database. Dr. Tracy Murphy is the state epidemiologist. He says the Department of Health rarely fields calls of that nature.
The health department does not have a regulatory role in that in Wyoming. So I think most of those concerns and complaints probably go to the regulatory agency. But occasionally we do get environmental concerns from folks. And when we get those, we take an epidemiologic approach, interview people, try to find out what the concerns are, see if there really are concerns that seem to be related, then we'll try to reach out to more people in the area to get an idea, not just limit it to those who have called, and we'll work with the partners like the Department of Environmental Quality and see if there is any monitoring data or anything that we could use, and then we try to decide if we think that, you know, there really are concerns there, how many are they related, and could they be associated with an environmental issue? The Wyoming Department of Health does not have a proactive environmental health section, as some states do, like Colorado.
Well, my recollection is you did get involved with Sublette County ozone situation. How exactly did that happen where you'd get involved? And then what were you able to do in that situation?
As DEQ, the Department of Environmental Quality, was working on the issue there, they would invite us to the table to talk about the health risks from ozone in general, and we would accompany them to some of the community meetings. And then in that process, the citizens there started expressing health concerns and wanting to know what we could tell them about the impact on health having in the area. And there just began to be increased interest in that information from the citizens, and then that spurred us to do the study on health impacts from ozone in Sublette County. And it took over a year to do. We had to design a study and do it. These type of things do take time and expertise, and without staff devoted to environmental health in our department, you know, we're limited in what we can do, but when we do get complaints and concerns and they seem to be valid, then we try to do what we can.
Yeah, what would typically be a concern that you seem to get maybe more often than another?
I'm not really sure on the environmental health issue is if there is one more common than the other. We get things ranging from people concerned that somebody has sprayed a pesticide in the area that could be harmful, to people concerned about fumes from factories, people concerned about the oil and gas flaring, odors. It really runs the gamut. I'd say it's pretty variable.
Do you ever, track these things or maybe put a file together or a database together, just kind of keeping an eye on things if you're starting to hear from maybe a specific area of the state or from something that's going on? I think about where maybe there might be a boom and you're starting to get a lot of complaints or hearing from doctors facing things. Do you track those things and keep a database?
We do not have an active surveillance system for environmental health complaints like we do for infectious disease and cancer. Mm-hmm. So when we do investigate, of course, we write up reports and keep those files. You know, since we don't get that many complaints and we're a relatively small department, we do keep track in our heads and just know if we're seeing a lot of complaints from a certain area, and then that would raise our concerns, and we would look at it closer. So while we don't have an official tracking system, I think given our situation, if there was an increase in concerns from an area, I'm pretty confident that we would note it. And then, of course, we would try to do something more proactive on that.
Dr. Tracy Murphy is Wyoming's epidemiologist. We'll have more on this story from a regional perspective from our state impact team in coming days. When we come back, we'll have a feature on efforts in Wyoming to legalize same-sex marriage and a conversation on Wyoming long-term care. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck. Public opinion in Wyoming has radically shifted towards legalizing same-sex marriage in the last decade. Bills both legalizing and banning have been introduced in the state legislature, but nothing has passed. And lawmakers are slow to acknowledge the shift in public opinion. But as Wyoming Public Radio's intern Aaron Jones reports, the legislature might not be where the change happens.
State Representative Matt Green grew up without gay marriage on his mind.
I will admit it really never came up. Talking about what's going on in our lives, gay marriage wasn't a topic that came up at the dinner table.
He says he didn't know anyone who was out growing up. The first time he met someone who was gay was in the military, which he joined in 2001. But even then, they didn't talk about it.
And with Don't Ask, Don't Tell, never really asked and people didn't tell because you didn't want to get anybody in trouble.
After leaving the military, he got into politics. There he realized it was time to develop a stance. At first, he thought civil unions were a fair compromise. But after seeing that more churches were performing gay marriages, he changed his mind. He recently voted on an unsuccessful effort to legalize gay marriage.
And there's been a seismic shift within the people of Laramie and nationally regarding a support of gay marriage.
That's backed up by a Williams Institute poll that says support for gay marriage increased in Wyoming from 26% in 2004 to 41% in 2012. Jaron Artery says that Green is typical. He works with a group, Wyoming Equality, that advocates for legalization of gay marriage. Artery says the change has been largely propelled by more gays and lesbians coming out.
We found that's the quickest way to change hearts and minds and attitudes is by folks saying, you know what, I am here, and I live in Wheatland, I live in Torrington, I live in Rock Springs, and we're here.
I represent a portion of Laramie. My son legally has two moms.
That's Representative Kathy Connolly. She's the only openly gay Wyoming legislator. Right now, Wyoming state law defines marriage as between a man and a woman. Connolly would like to see that change.
We change our statutes from saying marriage is a civil contract between a man and a woman to saying marriage is a civil contract between two natural persons. Voila, we have marriage equality.
But even without a change in the wording, Wyoming law currently recognizes marriages from other states. Connolly says that means all kinds of marriages, including same-sex marriages. But she'd like more clarity. But there are some legislators that Connolly is unlikely to persuade anytime soon.
My last name is Gay.
Representative Gerald Gay of Casper.
And when I'm out campaigning door-to-door, I have a card that I hand out, and it says Gay in great big white letters. Most people take a step back and look at me like, what are you trying to sell me here? And I have to explain, wait a minute, it's my name.
In the most recent legislative session, Gay introduced a bill that would ban same-sex marriage.
The Bible's very clear that marriage was instituted by God and was for one man and one woman and, you know, for creation of a natural family.
Nevertheless, Gay says he won't reintroduce the bill, and he doesn't think anyone else will either. He says the decision should be in the hands of the public, not the legislature.
Find a sponsor for your bill and bring it forth as a constitutional amendment, and that way it becomes a referendum.
That would be one way. More likely, a decision will come from the courts. Four same-sex couples sued Wyoming in March for legalization. Lawsuits to legalize gay marriage have recently been successful in several states, including Utah, Oklahoma, and Virginia. But action is at a standstill there because of the appeal process. Jaron Artery with Wyoming Equality is optimistic that the suit in Wyoming will be successful. A decision is pending. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Erin Jones.
Wyoming ranks 16th in the nation when it comes to meeting the long-term health care needs of older residents. The ranking comes from a comprehensive state-by-state scorecard developed by AARP, the Commonwealth Fund, and SCAN Foundation. In Wyoming, unpaid family caregivers provide the bulk of care for older Wyoming residents, in part because long-term care is unaffordable for most middle-income families. AARP Wyoming's Associate Director Tim Lockwood says things aren't all that bad in the state, but he says they could be better.
Well, I would say for, you know, a small state, we're doing okay. We have shown improvement. The last time they did this long-term services scorecard, we were 20th, and so we've obviously made some gains. Some things like the ADRC being brought on board has helped bring that score up, and some other resources that have been increased as well. So I would say we're, in AARP's view, we're doing okay, but obviously there's some room for improvement.
You mentioned the ARDC. What exactly is that?
The ADRC is an agency that was funded by the Wyoming State Legislature that provides a way for people to reach out who have disabilities or are aging or have other needs, and they can reach out and say, here's what my issue is, and here's what I need some help with. And the ADRC can help put them in touch with a program or get them in touch with grants that help with, you know, things like getting oxygen in a home or different things like that. So, and that's what the ADRC stands for, is the Aging and Disability Resource Center.
Yeah, what are seem to be the long-term care needs that we're missing and still need to improve on?
Well, really, it's fairly general, because what we're looking at is a large influx of boomers coming in the next few years, and those boomers want to age at home. And so we need to look at what our numbers are for things like home health aides, transitioning back in the community when they do receive nursing home care or emergency care, and how well those are working. Because the boomers, historically, for the last decade or more, have been the caregivers for the current generation. And so those caregivers aren't necessarily going to be there available to help the boomers out. And so we want to make sure that we have the resources there to support those boomers aging at home. Because given the choice, I think most people want the low stress environment of aging at home rather than being in a nursing home or some other institution that just doesn't feel like home. And it's nothing against those nursing homes. They provide a very good service. But when people have the choice, they want to age at home.
My guess is having home health care is also quite a bit cheaper than being in a facility. And I'm wondering how that plays into how you look at things, too, in trying to develop more home health care providers.
Home-based care services is still only about 20%. Or 26%, while nursing home funding is at about 70% when you look at state funding for those things. So there is definitely a differential. And when you look at aging at home, you're looking at an average person probably costing about $15,000 to $16,000 a year. I believe that's about the range. And then when you look at nursing homes, you're looking at upwards of $63,000, $64,000 a year. So there's a big disparity in how much it costs to age in a nursing home versus aging at home. And when you're on a fixed income, and if unfortunately you did not plan well enough for costs like nursing homes and some of those other things, the aging at home might be your only choice.
One of the things that might be interesting to hear is you know, what changes are we making? What's happening out there in the world where people in the state are maybe recognizing this as an issue and are trying to address it?
Well, I think some of it comes back to we have a pretty good-sized boomer population out there, which includes some of our legislative leadership and members. And so they have experienced the caregiving, taking care of a loved one or or other family member or friend. And so they see those needs that are out there. But we're also looking at some of the things like, you know, the number of home health and personal care aides per 1,000 people that are age 65 and plus. And while that number is 34 previously, it's dropped to 28. And so that's per 1,000. That's not a huge number. And so there are some concerns for these small rural communities. How do we get in some of these resources, some of these individuals that can help support aging at home? And what do we do to keep them there?
I know some communities, Sheridan being one, have looked into what I guess is best termed as maybe some type of an assisted care facility where folks can maybe reside in a location and also have somebody on hand that might provide some medical services if necessary. Is that growing? Are more people or more communities looking at doing that, or is that still something we need to develop?
That in Sheridan, that's called the Greenhouse, and it is a growing trend. And it's just like you said, it's more of an assisted living, but they do have on-site medical type of support if they need it. But those people are a little more self-sufficient than what you might see in a nursing home or such. You know, they might have their own type of an apartment with a small kitchen and facilities and different things like that, a little more homey feeling. And you are seeing that grow and grow because of the exact issue with how do we provide home health care and help people to feel comfortable in aging. And this is one of those options.
Especially as we look at people probably living longer, correct?
Absolutely. You know, with the advances in technology and medicine and everything else, this is just going to continue to be a question. And the other thing we need to look at down the road is not just the boomer generation, but the next generations after that. Are we going to be prepared for things like this? So we want to make sure that we build a strong foundation for these resources and these services so that they can last for the long term.
Maybe just as a last question for you, Tim, is this a conversation you have with local civic leaders, or is this a conversation that you have with legislators, or both?
I think both. There's definitely some policy decisions that can be made that support these type of services. But you also need to go into the community and say, what do you provide for those individuals who want to age at home and how can we improve that? Or what are you doing right? What best practices do you have in your community that's worked wonders that we can share with other communities in Wyoming?
Tim Lockwood is with AARP Wyoming. Always nice chatting with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bob.
Coming up after our break, we will look into efforts to keep data collected from Wyoming students as private as possible, plus a story on the renovation of a Yellowstone hotel. You're listening to Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. Nationwide, including Wyoming, states are working to build huge databases that can track students from preschool all the way into the workforce. In the brave new world of big data, the thought is more information means smarter education policy decisions and improved learning. But some parents worry that these systems will go too far. Wyoming officials are working to find a balance. Wyoming Public Radio's Aaron Schrank reports.
At Laramie County Community College, a classroom full of people is talking about control groups and independent variables. It's not as exciting as it sounds, but it is important. This is a workshop on Wyoming's new Statewide Longitudinal Data System, or SLDS. It's a comprehensive database that, when up and running, will be able to track students throughout their schooling and beyond.
Well, I saw it as a great opportunity to come down and talk about different ways that we might be able to use the SLDS to answer questions that we have in higher education.
That's Martha Davey, who works in academic services at Central Wyoming College in Riverton.
One of the questions that we have been unable to answer as community colleges is whether or not our students are being employed.
It's a good question, and one SLDS could theoretically answer. The technology does allow data to be shared across agencies, and not just in education. A school could agree to share data with the Department of Workforce Services or the Department of Health. The scope of the system has parents like Kelly Simone worried.
Why is this much data necessary in order to educate children when we've gone all this time without this much information?
Simone and others have been traveling to school board meetings around the state, raising concerns about SLDS. She says it could do a student more harm than good.
Down the road, the child's applying to go to med school, and the college can now look back longitudinally and see what health issues this child has had or behavioral issues this child has had. That could affect their ability to get into school. It could affect their ability in careers.
We don't want information that says this student got in trouble in the second grade and therefore this decision. It's not designed for that, and we want to make sure that that privacy is protected.
That's Flint Waters. He's Wyoming's chief information officer. He heads the Department of Enterprise Technology Services and is basically the guy putting the SLDS mechanism together for the state. He says the longitudinal data systems many states use might go too far, but Wyoming's system will be conservative.
We're designing a solution where we don't allow dumping all the data in one bucket. We're building out methods of sharing data between disparate systems, but not in such a way that the originating agency, who can oversee how it's properly represented, lose control over it.
What he means is ETS will set security standards and oversee data sharing agreements for school districts and all other agencies. The sale of student data to private companies will be prohibited. Also, student records will be anonymous. In most cases, students would be identified in a shared data set by a number, not a name. But sometimes, Waters says, that might not go far enough.
A school with 7 students? Is that data truly anonymized? Is it possible?
In such cases, Waters recommends these records be excluded from data exchanges. Waters says every proposed use of student data, no matter how well-intentioned, should be weighed against privacy concerns.
I think that it's really important that as those questions are formulated, a privacy impact review is done. We look and say, in order to answer that question, what would we have to gather to do it? And is it right to do it?
The legislature is also very interested in the issue. This year, it passed a law to firm up a student data security plan. At a recent Joint Education Committee meeting, Wyoming Department of Education's Leslie Zimmerscheid told lawmakers they're making progress.
We are very serious about student privacy and protecting the data that is entrusted to us. And as a result of the legislation, we really want to make sure that the policies that we have and the guidelines that we follow are available on our website for anyone to access.
The department expects to have that information on its website by the end of the year. Another piece of legislation established a data privacy task force. Senator Chris Rothfuss chairs that task force and says he needs to hear more proof that the ends justify the means.
I'm still not entirely convinced that having a massive treasure trove of data on every student actually has improved any student scores, so to speak. I don't see that yet.
In the meantime, as legislators and state officials develop policies and procedures, Rothfuss says he prefers to err on the side of privacy rather than data gathering.
Those types of systems probably are very useful for a functional and efficient government. If we know everything about you, we can probably be a great government for you, whether you like it or not.
Rothfuss says to protect privacy, more legislation is needed and expected. In other words, there remains serious questions and concerns. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Aaron Schrank.
These reports are part of The American Graduate, Let's Make It Happen. It's a public media initiative to address the dropout crisis, supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. A dozen or more trains carrying crude oil from the Bakken region are moving across northern Montana every week, skirting the edge of Glacier National Park. More trains, far fewer in number, pass through populated regions farther south. Governor Steve Bullock released the route information this week, making Montana the latest state to buck Railroad's request to keep the information out of public hands. Inside Energy's Dan Boyce reports.
Chief legal counsel in the Montana governor's office, Andy Huff, points to the state's constitution, which has a very strong provision, the public's right to know.
Which is a constitutional right for Montanans and people in Montana to examine government documents.
So pretty much all information the government has is open for inspection.
The only reason that we can prevent the public from viewing documents is if there's a privacy interest that outweighs the public right to know.
The Federal Department of Transportation recently issued emergency disclosure rules for crude oil shipments. As of early this month, trains carrying more than 1 million gallons of crude oil from the Bakken region in North Dakota and Montana have to tell states when and where those trains are rolling through. Bakken oil is believed to be more volatile, more dangerous and explosive than oil from other regions.
There's a rail line right in the middle of downtown Billings. There's one right in downtown Missoula, some of our biggest towns in Montana.
Durf Johnson is a staff attorney with the nonprofit Montana Environmental Information Center.
To think of the devastation that could be caused if something were to go wrong, it's incredibly concerning.
You're hearing a YouTube video of firefighters among smoking, crumbled brick structures. It's in the small town of Lac-Mégantic, Quebec, the aftermath of an oil train explosion which killed almost 50 people last summer. This past April, hundreds were evacuated from downtown Lynchburg, Virginia, after another fiery crash. The federal government wants first responders and emergency planners to know about these trains so they can be prepared for a worst-case scenario. Railroad companies have been arguing that's all who should know. And several states like Wyoming and Colorado have agreed they will not publicly release the data. The railroad company BNSF ships by far the most Bakken crude on its trains, 80% in fact, according to Inside Energy Analysis. BNSF argued the release of this information would harm competitiveness, and they say it could compromise security. But apparently the feds don't agree. Andy Huff with the Montana Governor's Office says they asked federal officials about the railroad's concerns.
And they told us no, that it wasn't sensitive security information.
BNSF wouldn't talk on tape for this story, but in a statement they say they will continue to supply the route information to state agencies. And what happens then is apparently up to the states. Environmentalist Durf Johnson is happy the public now has this information, but he hopes more steps are taken soon.
Increased safety standards surrounding oil trains, increased track inspections, lower speed limits.
The Department of Transportation is considering tighter safety regulations regarding the type of tank cars transporting oil, regulations which could cost the industry billions. For Inside Energy, I'm Dan Boyce.
To see animated maps of where crude shipments begin and end, go to insideenergy.org. Inside Energy is a reporting collaboration of public radio and TV stations in Wyoming, Colorado, and North Dakota. Changing gears, Yellowstone Park is celebrating completion of a two-year, $29 million renovation of its oldest lodge, the Lake Hotel. Now, all of the Lake Hotel's redecorated rooms are ready for guests now. Penny Preston reports people worked through two bitter winters to complete the project.
In 1889, 27 years before there was a National Park Service, construction began on Lake Hotel. It is Yellowstone's oldest. 2 years ago, reconstruction started.
The hotel had been touched pretty harshly over the years.
That's reconstruction architect Dennis Johnson. He says it was a challenge to return the hotel to the colonial revival period architecture. With yellow clapboard siding and 50-foot columns, the grand structure reflects the taste of wealthy visitors from the East in the late 1800s, not the rustic Old Faithful style. Yet, Old Faithful architect Robert Reamer added these and other decorations, including the sunroom, a portico chair, and tiled fireplace. The recent reconstruction took place through two winters, with temperatures as low as 36 below zero. And, oh yes, there were earthquakes.
There were some earthquakes. There was a pretty good one here this spring from the Norris earthquake that did reach down here and did a little bit of damage.
Earthquakes were the primary reason for the reconstruction. Reconstruction Superintendent Patrick Marble says they worked hard to make sure it can withstand more in the future.
I mean, you see the columns in this room, and a lot of those columns we had to put in structural steel in. You know, so we literally ended up supporting massive sections of a building that was built in 1891, a huge historical landmark.
The park recently celebrated the final phase of the reconstruction. Phase two remodeled more than half the hotel's rooms, from peeling wallpaper and problem plumbing to a luxury room with the view. Concessionaire Zanterra paid for the hotel rehab. Park Superintendent Dan Wink noted historic preservation is one of the challenges the park faces.
These great old historic structures take a lot of maintenance. They take a lot of care.
In his congratulatory speech, Wink announced new protections in the works for the 123-year-old structure.
The hotel just passed the first hurdle for designation as a National Historic Landmark, the highest level of significance and protection under the National Historic Preservation Act.
Wink said the approval is expected late this year. Even as the ribbon-cutting ceremony celebrated the completion of the latest facelift, Wink looked forward to the challenges of the next milestone, 2016.
2016 marks the 100th anniversary of the creation of the National Park Service.
Wink noted Yellowstone is much older and will celebrate its 144th anniversary in 2016.
But 2016 is really an opportunity, I think, for the nation to look at the parks and to understand what kind of future stewardship these great places are going to take to have them be places of great resource preservation.
From Yellowstone National Park, I'm Penny Preston, reporting for Wyoming Public Radio.
When we come back, we'll take you to the site of a mammoth dig and hear the latest edition of our series called Wyoming Stories. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck. It's time now for Wyoming Stories. Meteetse residents Jim and Joan Dunrood remember Jim's parents' famous neighbor at the Double D Ranch. Her name was Amelia Earhart.
Dad was a ranger in the park for 4 years, and one of his jobs was to take George Putnam, was ahead of the party that was doing all the scientific information on in the geyser basin. And so they got to be pretty good friends. And then later on, George Putnam married Amelia Earhart, and that's where we got acquainted with her. And she was really, really a nice lady, Mom always said. And she really liked the country. And when they lived there at the Double D, she had their cabin was kind of on the river bank, and Jozier Creek was not really a very big creek, but she said she liked the restful sound of the river there. And anyway, Dad started building her a cabin there, and he got it just about four logs high in 1937, and when she's lost, so that was the end of the cabin. Didn't do any more there, but whatever happened to her is still a mystery.
I think Jim's folks felt very sad when hearing that she'd gone down at sea. Jim's mom said she was a lovely lady. She really, really, really liked Amelia Earhart. She said she was just a very, very kind lady. She really was good to the kids, and later sent them a lot of presents. And Vera was, well, I don't think she warmed to George as much. She said he could be rather officious sometimes. But she said Amelia was always a very gracious lady, and she really did like her. And I think they always sort of regretted that she had to die so young.
That's Joan and Jim Dunrood from Meteetse. Amelia Earhart's plane, of course, disappeared over the Pacific Ocean on July 2nd, 1937. Remember, you can always hear more Wyoming stories at our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. While we have a short break, we should mention last weekend in Washington, D.C., Open Spaces was named the best news and public affairs program in the nation among mid-sized stations. That category of stations, by the way, is the largest in public radio, and we are very excited with the news. Willow Belden also received a second-place award for best news feature. Her story was on Pinedale and Sublette County ozone, and Irina Zhuroff got a first-place award for the best use of sound. Her story was on the women's antelope hunt. Congratulations to everyone who was part of those awards. Moving on with the program, in 1986, a large mammoth rib bone was found jutting out of the bank of a creek a few miles from Douglas. The state archaeologist George Frizzin did a hasty four-day excavation at the time. But a thorough excavation has never been done because the landowners were not interested in hosting an archaeology dig on their property, leaving archaeologists with a big question. Is Laprelle Creek a mammoth kill site? But recently, the land sold, and archaeologists have finally been allowed to dig. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards has the story.
Under the hot sun next to Laprelle Creek, UW anthropology professor Todd Servell and several of his field school students are hunched over a curved mound protruding from the ground. It's the size and shape of a French baguette, and it's the rib of an Ice Age mammoth. They're getting the bone ready to remove, very carefully.
What I'm thinking we'll do is remove it as a block, so we'll wrap the whole thing in plaster and then take it out as one big piece.
Servell says to prove it's a kill site, they need to find human stone tools. Colorado State anthropology professor Richard Adams believes he did just that.
It was a purely fortuitous discovery. I was enlarging the trail to make it safer for people with buckets, and ting, hit it with a shovel.
It was a stone chopper,
probably a heavy-duty butchery tool. And two large stone tools called cobbles were also found in the dig. But UW anthropology professor Robert Kelly, who's co-teaching the field school with Surivel, isn't so sure.
I've changed my mind each day that we've been here. So today I'm thinking that there was some human involvement with this particular mammoth.
But if I come and ask you this question tomorrow?
Who knows?
Okay.
Yeah. Kelly says the reason mammoth kill sites are so exciting and rare is because they tell us so much about the Paleo-Indian people who managed to use stone tools to bring down a 10-ton elephant.
There was probably a great deal of stealth, a lot of skill in knowing exactly where you're going to have to hit an elephant in order to kill it. It would almost certainly have to be a group endeavor because you're going to have to hit it multiple times in order to kill it. It would not have been easy.
There are also other even harder questions that the scientists in the dig are exploring. 88-year-old geoarchaeologist Vance Haynes is one of the world's foremost authorities on mammoth digs, and for many years has been trying to uncover the mystery of how they became extinct.
There's no camel, there's no horse, there's bison. Bison survived, probably because there were so many of them that natural selection left some, you know, whatever caused the extinction, which is, you know, that's the $64 question.
Robert Kelly says kill sites like this one can help answer those questions. He says it's hard to know whether humans wiped out the mammoths or whether it was natural climate change.
Large animals like mammoths, some archaeologists think that they were a focus of subsistence. Others figure that, they might have killed one mammoth in their lifetime and then never stopped talking about it.
The crew probably won't solve the big mysteries of the Ice Age this summer, but Kelly and Surivel both agree that enough evidence of human activity has been found during this dig to warrant another dig next year. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
To see photos of that mammoth rib bone and the chopping tool, you can visit our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Thank you for listening to Open Spaces. If you'd like to hear the program again, you can go to our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. There you can sign up for our podcast and listen to individual segments and comment on them. Our web editor is Anna Rader. You may also pitch us ideas for future shows at that same site. Should mention that all of our reporters, including our new ones, are on Twitter, and we also invite you to become a fan of our Facebook page. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News. We'll